House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:18 on February 5th. Members present are Gabrielle, or Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, Representative Josephson, Representative Keto, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum. Please turn off your cell phones. Sorry we missed Representative Josephson on that by about a minute, but today we have one item on the calendar, and that's a presentation by the Division of Retirement and Benefits. From the Department of Administration, we have John Boucher, Deputy Commissioner, and Michelle Michaud, Chief Health Officer from the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Thank you for joining us today, and you've definitely got our undivided attention. Do you feel comfortable with us cutting in and asking questions as we go along, or we can save them for the end, whatever?
Your preference, Mr. Chair.
So we'll probably just do them as we go along. It usually speeds it up that way.
Sure. That's fine.
And thanks again for joining us.
You bet.
Please read yourself onto the record.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is John Boucher. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Administration, and with me is my right arm as far as the health care plans for the state of Alaska, Michelle Michaud. She's the Chief Health Official at the Division of Retirement Benefits. And today,
I'd like to record to reflect that we have a full committee. We've been joined by Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And continuing, our plan today to give you an overview of Alaska Care Health Plan, as well as a status report on our largest health care third-party administrator, Aetna. So, first of all, just to give you a sense of the size and scope of the health care plans that the Division of Retirement and Benefits administers. We administer a program that covers over 86,000 lives, and that's a fairly large number. About 80% of that total program is in our retiree plan, and the remaining 20% is in the employee plan. So roughly those numbers are near 70,000 retirees and their dependents, and roughly 16,700 or so employees and their dependents. As you can see, not surprisingly, looking at the ratios, of course, the employees tend to have more dependents and the retirees less dependents as we look at. So that can change in terms of what the important issues are for those individuals. In terms of the total number of employee plans that fall under what I would describe as the Alaska Care umbrella, we administer 10 plans currently, and we're about to add an 11th. In the employee space, we have 7 different plans that we administer. 3 of those are our employee medical and prescription drug programs. We have 2 dental programs, and one vision program. Oh, excuse me, yes. Sorry, slide number 3. And then we have a healthcare flexible spending account that also is part of the plans that we administer. In the retiree space, we have fewer plans. We have the retiree medical prescription drug plan, an optional dental vision and audio plan, which is essentially a package grouped together, and the long-term care plan. And we also are planning on rolling out fairly soon a new plan for our defined contribution retirees. And all of those plans are essentially managed. Michelle and her staff of 6 is the group that largely does all the interface with these contractors, resolves most of the issues. Of course, she has support from other staff within retirement and benefits, such as the customer call center that supports the entire R&B agency, as well as IT professionals. But largely most of the interface of the plans happens through Michelle and her staff. Slide number 4. Just to give you an idea of the model, for those of you who don't know the history of how Alaska Care is administered, We've been self-insured since approximately 1997, and the state contracts with third-party administrators to process claims and help us execute the plans.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Culver, followed by Representative.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner, can you explain the, or just maybe identify the satisfaction levels with Aetna as the administrator, plan administrator, versus I think you, the last one you had was Wells Fargo, or maybe that was further back, but where are we at with customer satisfaction?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Culver, I actually have a slide of that if you'd like to move or at least take a glance to that, or we can postpone it till we get to that slide.
Yeah, we'll just get to it.
Okay. Is that okay, Representative Colton?
Sure. And then follow-up, Mr. Chair. We had some issues with MOTA, but the dental plan is financially sound?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, yes, that is correct. Although MOTA is the umbrella name that is used, there are essentially multiple companies under the MOTA umbrella. For the dental plan, we contract with Oregon Dental Service, and that is a separate entity from MOTA Health, which MOTA Health was the entity that was recently asked to withdraw or is in the process of being looked at by the Division of Insurance.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this slide answers my slide from my question from the first slide as far as the multiple plans, 7 plans to administer under employee, 3 plans to administer under retiree. But they're they're either under Aetna or MOTA, basically, so we're not talking various insurance companies. However, just wondering, all these multiple plans, do all the people get put into the same pool to reduce the cost, or are they all separate pools and therefore the cost is higher?
Actuarially, they're provided there are different rates for different risk pools within the plans, and so and partially all how much premium you pay, for example, is dependent upon the type of plan that you have.
Follow-up. And why is that? Wouldn't it be cheaper if they were all combined into one risk pool, or is it done in some way that I don't understand to save? Or is it based on union contracts, or why?
Well, there's a number of factors in terms of the overall reasons for that. In terms of the employee benefit credit that is given, some of those are negotiated and some of those are not, and so in some cases it is a matter of collective bargaining.
So essentially we are paying more because they're all separately in different risk pools and negotiated separately. Is that correct?
Paying more. Representative Hughes, through the chair, what?
Mr. Chair, just that it's a higher cost to the state and the higher rates. In other words, my understanding, the larger the risk pool, the better rates you get.
Yes, that is in. We do have a retiree risk pool and employee risk pool that is blended across the two. So in terms of the employees and the retirees, separate funds pay for those, but there is a blended rate across the employee plan.
Follow-up.
I'm sorry to go on, because earlier you said they were separate different risk pools, and now you're saying it's blended, so I'm confused. Can you please clarify, is it all one risk pool and is all the same rates? I don't think it is, because you said they negotiate different things. I'm just trying to look at this and think, how could we save money? And are we doing it in the lowest cost way, is my question. And
so I guess I'm inarticulately explaining this. The risk pool for all the employees is one risk pool. However, the amount of benefit or the amount that the individual pays into the plan is dependent upon the benefit that they get. And so it is considered from an insurance perspective, I believe one risk pool for the employees and one for the retirees.
Okay.
But the benefit credit that the employee is allowed to provide toward the buying their particular plan is can be a negotiated item.
I hate to jump in line, but it might help clear it up for Representative Hughes. We're not buying insurance, we buy reinsurance.
Correct.
We're virtually self-insured for what, up to what? Several million?
I believe, what is the policy for an individual?
What is the amount that the state retains? You're not cashing in on insurance. I mean, we ought to be cutting the checks paid by the state of Alaska, because in all reality, the state is paying for the claims.
Correct.
And then we have excess insurance to pick up premies, major ticket health issues, high value payments. But virtually the state is picking up the... That's why it is one pool, because they're... Until you get up into the upper layers, you don't really have insurance kicking in.
Yes, and so essentially the premiums pay for the premiums and the reserves that have accumulated over time pay for the claims and the administration of the plan.
Okay. Representative Kito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Bachelor. That was kind of the question I was getting to, is how are we as far as premiums covering the costs, number one, and then number two, what kind of a reserve do we have? Do we have a 1 month, 3 month, 5 month reserve?
I actually have a slide on that later. It's to answer your question, though, briefly at this point in time, Representative Kito, through the chair, our reserves have been shrinking significantly in the last 12 months, and that's an issue that we're having to manage and address.
And that's so.
Next slide. So just to give you an idea of the amount of healthcare spend, and this is, as I recall, this is just medical and prescription, is that?
No, this is, excuse me, this is all of the spend, but it's based on the actual claims wire, so this is what we pay on a monthly basis or within this period of time, rather than when the claims were actually incurred, so.
So to give you an idea of the total, spends about $627 million in fiscal year 2015. And what we've seen both across the retiree and the active health care plan is generally an increase in the spend year over year. One thing that we've been somewhat surprised is because in the active care health plan, we actually have less people participating in the plan, but it does appear that there has been increased utilization. And so it could be one of the things that we have they're thinking that may be contributing to increased utilization is that there's uncertainty within the workforce a little bit. So but we're not certain, but that is one reason that we may think this is happening.
Representative Kito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boucher, one of the things I think we were told when we switched providers is that the provider was going to come in, and actually the reason they were selected is because we were going to actually decrease the healthcare costs. We have been hearing, at least in my office, of claims denied and individuals that are having difficulty trying to get covered, and even with that circumstance, I guess I'm a little concerned that we have such a significant increase in the costs of health care when that was part of the reason for the selection process to identify the new administrator.
Yeah, Representative Kito, through the chair, I do believe that our third-party administrator still is delivering significant network savings, and we could actually be experiencing a higher trend without them in place. If you look at national trends right now, 9% is not necessarily uncommon from the information that we've received from our consultants. One of the things that's driving that is there is a significant increase in the cost of pharmaceuticals right now. Those trends are going in the neighborhood of double digits because of new drugs that are being introduced for certain therapies.
Representative Ledoux.
We may have missed this because I walked out for a few couple of minutes. What do we pay our administrator?
Let's see. I'm sure we have those.
If it's on another slide.
We have the numbers. As far as Aetna in fiscal year 15, the overall fee was about $16.4 million, and in 16, the base fee is 15.5 with a potential 3.6 at risk. Our contract is structured so that there are either performance guarantees or earnbacks that have to be earned as part of an incentive. So,
follow up.
And how would an administrator earn bonus points?
Well, it's based on, for instance, we have various benchmarks related to service. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I apologize. Related to service, for instance, at our call center, we have a number of other performance guarantees that they have to meet certain targets.
Follow up.
So do they get points for holding down the amount that the state spends?
There
is a claims trend guarantee.
So, one more. So, like, wouldn't that be kind of an incentive for them to maybe be denying claims that maybe should not be denied? Like, every once in a while you read about some real insurance company denying cancer treatments or denying this or denying that in order to, because they don't want to pay it?
I'm sorry, Representative Ledoux, mm-hmm. through the chair. We have actually numerous performance guarantees. I think there's over 100 of them, but most of those are structured towards claims accuracy and timeliness, and so that would counteract, them denying in order to achieve the claims trend.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. For Mr. Boucher, the $627 million, is that premiums paid or is that charges incurred by Alaskans at various medical offices or hospitals?
That is
claims wires itself, so it's only the medical services received, not the administrative fees.
Okay.
So payment to providers, I guess, is one. Yeah. Or individuals for medical services.
Okay. And a follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
There's six legislators here. The coverage is about $1,400 a month. That's like $10,000 for February, if I've got that right. A little bit less, maybe. If none of us went to a provider in February, Aetna is going to receive $9,000 for our coverage. And what will it do with that money that we're not asking any service for? Do you know what happens? I assume it goes to provide for someone who has cancer that's a state worker. Or do they, is there some simple answer?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, they don't have the money. They pay the claims and then they bill us for the claims. So we retain those funds until such time that a claim is incurred.
So they don't hold the cash. The cash stays with the state, Representative Josephson.
The money from the premium is aggregated, mm-hmm. and then you either have a stop loss or you have a limit where the reinsurance kicks in, say at $5 million and the aggregate or $10 million or whatever, and then they either get a 100% or you can get a percentage, 75 or 80%. I suspect you guys probably get 100, but not having seen the plan in a long time. But, you know, all the money goes in, and their best guess is whatever the insurance actually kicks in at, that they collect enough premium over the 12 months to pay the anticipated claims. And anything above that is where the insurance gets a lot cheaper if somebody like the state is picking up what's called the working layer, which is where it's anticipated that virtually all the claims will hopefully fall into. But the balance is, or the key is trying to get the balance to where you collect enough premium to cover the claims that you're accurate, and that's what keeps the ultimately keeps the rates down. Is if we have best guesses that turn out to be pretty accurate. And if I'm wrong, feel free to butt in.
I won't say that I'm an insurance expert. So I want to pause, or did I jump over a slide? No. I kind of want to pause here, going back. This is to Representative Keto's earlier question. If you look at this slide, and particularly the bar chart, you can see that really between the period of about fiscal year 2010 to fiscal year 2012 and 13, you saw some pretty significant increases in the overall health care cost. And the previous administration, at that point in time, after seeing several years of those, chose to structure the current RFP to try to address this health care trend. And one of the significant features, as Representative Keto pointed out, was the value of the network that the TPA would bring. And so we have seen over the last few years that we have been able to contain costs. But I also want to say that during that time, that there was also a buildup in reserves that were available to the plan. And so there was a conscious policy decision to essentially set the rate lower so that the reserves would gradually be eroded. And I think going in fiscal year 16, we did see a bending of the health care spend trend during 2014. But then it appears like about middle of 2015, we saw the reemergence of underlying growth in the overall claims, and essentially what has resulted is that the rates for fiscal year 2016 were probably set too low, and we're in a position now that at least we're forecasting that we could have a very small reserve at the beginning of fiscal year 17. And so we're essentially looking at four levers to try to address that particular problem. And first of all, we're looking at plan design changes that may help bend that cost trend. We're in the process of negotiating with providers to try to address those costs. And we're also in the process of collective bargaining, and we hope to address the employee contribution to the healthcare plans within that process. And we probably will be looking also for an increase in the employer contribution. But that's we don't quite know where we're going to land there yet. So I want to now talk about some of the Aetna portion. This is more of the Aetna portion of the discussion. In calendar year 2015, Aetna processed roughly 2.9 claims lines, which is quite a volume for those roughly 86,000 people. The average turnaround is 14 calendar days. And one of the interesting features of our plan is that a significant number of our overall claims have to be hand processed. Nearly 46% of those 3 million claims are touched by a human and looked at. And so that slows processing times, it makes our administration more expensive, and it can also potentially introduce errors. Our year-to-date claims accuracy, we're estimating about 97%, But when you think about it, if it's roughly 3 million claims, 3% of 3 million is 90,000. And so that, to me, sounds like a big number. So I think we still have a ways to go in terms of claims accuracy. And so, and also, too, if we could get to a place where we were more auto adjudication, I think we would have both faster claims and potentially reduce error rates as well.
Representative Hito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boucher, can you talk a little bit about the auto adjudication process? And I think one of the concerns I have is if we've got a claim, and I guess my sense is that the first step is within Aetna, and then it goes to the state to be reviewed. Can you let me know what the claim support for those claims is for Aetna? Does the state support 90% of Aetna's initial claims, or does the state turn over 90% of those claims?
Through the chair, Representative Tito, I'll take a first guess at this, and hopefully the next slide will answer your question. In terms of adjudication, so a claim could be adjudicated either through a computer-generated process or by hand. And then the result of that claim could be a denial or whatever. So, and all of those processes, whether they be hand or computer, are within Aetna. And then, but if, for instance, there is an appeal process that the member receives something that they disagree with, then within the first, there can be essentially what can be an administrative review within Aetna of that process, and then there can be if so. For instance, there could have been a claims processing error that Aetna might realize and overturn at that point. Then there is what we describe as a level two appeal, which that can go to two paths. If it's largely an administrative type claim, that is reviewed again within Aetna itself. Or if it is a clinical type issue, it can go to an outside person. It's an outside review board called an ERO. It's essentially a three-person panel that takes a look at that particular claim. It can be overturned there. Between level two and level three is where the division tends to get involved, if we do get involved. Does that help answer your question?
That does, and I think maybe if you could explain the next slide when we get to that will help.
Representative LeBeau.
So when it says the average turnaround time is 14.2 calendar days, is that the period of time that it takes between the time that the physician has usually submitted the claim to the point where you pay the physician? Is that what, or Aetna pays the physician? Is that what you're talking about there?
So, Representative Ledoux, through the chair, yes, that's typically from when the provider submits the claim, and nowadays most of those are submitted electronically. So once that electronic submission is received to when the payment is paid, whether it be to the provider or in the case of a member submitting their own claim back to the member.
Paula?
So then how long after Aetna turns over its claim to the state does the state pay Aetna? Would that be in the contract with Aetna, how long the state has to do that?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, we actually receive a claims wire daily, or a billing daily, and submit claims daily with the third-party administrator. So they would submit for the previous day's claims, and we would pay them. And we have, I believe, 10 days to pay from when we receive that. 10 working days, excuse me.
No question, follow up.
And do you follow up? And do you take all 10 working days?
I'm not sure.
I'm just thinking that if you have 10 working days and there's basically a lot of money, and I'm assuming that it's sitting there earning interest that it would make sense to take every single one of those 10 working days?
We can check into that, Representative Ledoux. My sense, though, is that we try to pay our invoices as promptly as possible.
So. I think we're going to have to wait until the prime gets a lot higher before we see insurance companies doing that again. But you're right, it was common practice a number of years ago when the prime was much higher than what it is now.
Moving on to slide 8. So this puts into perspective a little bit the numbers that we have going through the appeal process. These are our total numbers at the various levels that I earlier described for total appeals. And this would be retiree and employee-related health plan appeals. So we had approximately 1,200 or so appeals closed at level one. And then of the two types of level two appeals, we had 131 that were closed that were what I would describe as the administrative. And that's of those, about 20 of level one and level two. So those are essentially handled by Aetna. About 23% of those that we see that come through the door are overturned.
I'd like to acknowledge we've been joined by Representative Max Grunberg, and you're welcome to have a seat at the table if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, I'm having a question prepared, and I'll try to get it to your staff.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Right. And then so for the other type of level two, at about 52 of those closed during the course of the year, and the overturn rate at that level for level two was 29%. And then depending on whether you're a retiree or in the active plan, we had 21 go to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and those essentially pass through the Division of Retirement Benefits before they go on to the final step. We try to make sure that nothing goes to the final level without us taking a good hard look at it to make sure that this should properly go on to the final level.
Representative Ledoux.
What's the difference between these two level twos? Why do some of them go to Aetna and some of them go to the external review?
Michelle, please help me out if I misstate this. In the external review appeal, there is a medical component that may be at issue, whether or not a certain procedure, for instance, is medically necessary, according to the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so a panel of physicians, medical personnel, that look at that, independent of Aetna, and rule on that. Does that help, Representative Ledoux?
It does, but then can I just follow up? Then what's the ones that go to Aetna? I mean, so you've got the level two external review being decided by the independent panel of physicians. So what does the other level two do?
Those are administrative in nature, and I'll rely on Michelle to give you an idea of what those types
are. Okay.
Right. So, Representative Ledoux, through the chair, the Aetna level two are the non-clinical. So that's if there was a math error done or perhaps coordination of benefits wasn't applied where there's two different plans. That would be something that Aetna would review at level two because there's no medical component. It's more of a math or bookkeeping type appeal.
Thank you.
Representative Kudo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boucher, the Level 3 Office of Administrative Hearings or Superior Court, of those, do we have any information about the overturn rate for those appeals?
I don't have that, but we can get that. I don't know, Michelle, do you have anything on that? Or?
I'd have to gather that. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, thank you. This external review, the panel of physicians, this is something that Aetna puts together. Are they truly independent, or do they receive any compensation from Aetna? And I'm assuming this happens somewhere in the lower 48. Or can you just explain that panel a little bit more, just so we understand it?
I
as I too have had constituents concerned about different things being turned down.
Representative Hughes, through the chair. Aetna does contract with three separate independent review organizations. This is something that's modeled from the Affordable Care Act. And so there is a rotation, and so it's not the same review panel. They don't get to pick which review panel gets the case. And so when a clinical appeal goes to level two, it is sent to whoever's next in that rotation of those three vendors.
I guess on a similar note, several years ago, the administration was looking at something called medical tourism. Have we implemented that on any kind of a level, or is that an option under Aetna to send people outside for treatment that might be done at a significantly lower cost?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't say that we have a robust medical tourism. So it seems like most of the procedures that we do are those that, for instance, might not be offered within the state of Alaska. So that is something, though, that given the current fiscal situation, I think employers around the state are having to take a good hard look at that. So and we're no different than those in terms of examining those options.
I think we're starting to see some of the workers' compensation carriers do it, and the several of the major unions have been doing it for since the TAPS construction. And Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Boucher, you said that you received notice from the insurance provider sort of on a daily basis about claims that need to be paid. Do I have that right?
It's Representative Josephson, through the chair, it's my understanding we get an invoice daily for the claims that were paid.
All right. And a follow-up on that, what is it that the invoice says? Does it say Billy, the truck driver with DOT on the Hall Road, has a sore back? What does it say?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I'll have to I don't know the answer to that question, but we can find it out.
Okay.
So you, next slide. You might be curious. Well, what are the areas that are most common in terms of the appeal process? Because this can give it can be signals as to do we have a part of the plan that's not well understood, that the benefit's not understood. Do we have an issue with communication about a certain part of the plan? Is there a misunderstanding? Is this an area of plan design that we should try to address? And so these are some of the categories that are really that tend to rise to the top. For instance, in chiropractic and physical therapy, there's a requirement that for continued treatment, after a certain amount of visits, you have to have a medical necessity. And so sometimes that becomes the issue in these particular appeals. In pharmacy, for example, it may be a non-covered type of drug, or perhaps they filled their prescription sooner than was allowed. So those are the types of issues we may run into.
Representative Josephson?
Actually, I'd like to go second. Representative Ledoux.
That's okay if you were.
You're both attorneys. Probably the same question,
okay.
Right?
So physical therapy or chiropractic medical necessity. So if the doctor, if somebody is seeing a doctor and the doctor prescribes physical therapy, in what situations are you going to second guess the doctor and say that that physical therapy is not necessary?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, in instances as this, especially in the retiree plan and to a lesser extent in the employee plan, because there's a cap on chiropractic in the employee plan, there is a requirement that it be an improved. Immediately improved significant improvement in bodily function must be occurring and expected to continue to occur. So what happens in a lot of these cases is you get to a point where you're no longer making any kind of improvement, and it's more appropriate to be done through home exercise or something like that. So that is when, that's where we have changed the plan to include that second level external review for clinical appeals, so that when there is a difference in opinion between what Aetna considers to be medical necessity and when it's appropriate to go, for example, to a home exercise program that is different than what the member's own physician had come up with. This is where that independent member comes in and reviews, independent doctor comes in and reviews the clinical evidence and the evidence-based medicine guidelines and makes a ruling as well. So as a tiebreaker, so to speak.
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Hughes.
Thank you. I guess this is a, through the chair, more of a comment than a question, but what's interesting about this, of course, none of this surprises me because we've all experienced interacting with insurance companies, but the pushback on single payer, and this came up a lot in the 2008 presidential election when a previous governor talked about death panels and this sort of thing. This has always been part of the insurance industry, not death panels, but the idea that there's going to be, it's not an open-ended, sure, go to 10 doctors, and if that doesn't work, try the 11th. And I think there's a real misunderstanding about that, and it's an education. I understand the need to control that, but it's a real education effort because there's a misunderstanding that insurance means, you know, everything. Any comment on that?
I'm Representative Josephson through the chair. You're absolutely right. I think that, and I apologize, I don't remember the source, but there are studies that have been done that have shown that up to 30% of healthcare services received in the United States were unnecessary or potentially even harmful. So there is a need to review to make sure that the evidence-based medicine is being applied, and that's what we rely on our third-party administrator and their medical expertise to do.
Does that include procedures that are done to protect the doctors from malpractice suits that might not be necessary but would give added protection, you know, additional tests or screening? Is that included in 30%?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I'd have to go back to the study to see what exactly they were, if they included that in their numbers.
Representative Ledoux.
So one of the concerns that I used to have when I lived in a rural area is the insurance only included or only covered, what was the phrase, what a normal physician would charge. I think there's a, you know what,
Recognized charge. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, not recognized charge, so to speak. So let's say that they charged more than it was normally. Is that what it's called? The
talking about the UCR?
Yes, it's also referred to as usual, customary, and reasonable.
Yes, exactly. So sometimes Kodiak only had two physicians, two clinics, and both of them were charging the same thing. And we'd get back on the insurance policy that X amount of dollars wasn't covered because this wasn't a customary and usual charge. And I never could comprehend that when both clinics were charging the same amount of money. And the only way you could avoid spending that money was to travel to Anchorage, which you wouldn't pay for. And yet the consumer ended up with having to pay a portion of the doctor's bill, which in my mind should have been covered, because if there are only two clinics, then that's what's usual and customary in the area.
Representative Ledoux through the chair. Yes, we do have usual customary language in our plan. We refer to it as recognized charge. And this is a problem throughout the nation, not just here but probably more so here because we are so geographically isolated in some cases. But what we do is we review, we rely on a company, a not-for-profit company called Fair Health. And Fair Health takes the claims, the billing claims from all the different payers, and then extrapolates them across the geographic area. So they determine the prevailing charge rate in a geographic area, but you're correct that the geographic area is not isolated down to a single zip code or a single area. So that does cause instances where members will be balance billed the difference.
Paula?
So is the usual and customary area or the recognized area, is that the whole state?
No. There are five separate geographic areas in the state, but, you know, Kodiak would not be on its own or you know, they're combined. So, and I'm sorry, I don't know what the five areas are off at the top of my head. I'd have to look that up. But what we hoped with Aetna coming in is that we could expand on our network and develop a robust network. If we could bring those two clinics into network, that would provide protection to the member against a balance bill.
Just one more follow-up. So what happens when the people, I mean, it's usually appealing is really kind of a hassle for a limited amount of money. But what have been the rulings when somebody has appealed those refusing to cover the charges?
We, Representative Ledoux through the chair, we did change our recognized charge terminology effective in January. I do not believe that we've had an appeal go forward on that, but with the ones here that have been at the Aetna level, they would have upheld the denial because it is the way that our plan document spells out the recognized charge, and so they are administering to our plan document. Now, as far as I know, there has not been one that has gone before Superior Court or OAH to challenge whether or not the language in the plan document is sufficient.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bullet about the physical therapy and the medical necessity, I am aware of a local resident in my area, and as I actually was thinking of it, what you're doing deals with one in eight or nine Alaskans between the current and employees and retirees, so it really impacts a lot of people, and I've gotten different calls and problem and heard about different problems, and in this case, the resident was referred by the doctor to physical therapy for an extended period of time. I'm not even sure what the exact problem was. Had all those visits and then was told after the visits that they weren't going to be covered, and I believe it was either $10,000 or $20,000. Now this person owed the physical therapy clinic and they're devastated. They're on a this was a retiree, limited income, and a very conscientious person of integrity who feels like they need to make that payment. So my question to you is, what was the notification? Was the, you know, and why was it so delayed as far as for the patient, the physical therapist, the doctor making the referrals? Why would this kind of situation occur? And I'm not sure which of you.
Okay. Representative Hughes through the chair. We, unfortunately, when you switch from one third-party administrator to another, they all have their own, and our plan historically has always relied on the medical necessity determination of the third-party administrator. And when you switch from one to the other, there are changes in what they consider medically necessary, and it's not always not because, you know, there's millions of different procedures out there, and to determine whether there's a difference between one procedure or the other is not always practical. We weren't immediately aware that, you know, where these differences would occur, so we weren't able to communicate them all sufficiently. We did communicate, and one of the things that we really appreciate that Aetna has is that they rely on clinical policy bulletins that outline what is medically necessary, and we did communicate that when we transitioned. maybe not as well as we should have, but it was communicated. And so the previous administrators have not had any kind of medical necessity guidelines that were available to the patient. Now with Aetna, the clinical policy bulletin is available online. Them and their provider can use that clinical policy bulletin to see what it is that Aetna is going to be using to determine medical necessity.
Certainly.
So the people that are getting seriously dinged, it's during this transition time. So once a transition is complete, then would Aetna or the department or whoever be notifying the physician, the physical therapy clinic, and the patient so this wouldn't occur? And so that the people that, you know, the communication wasn't adequate, they're having to pay for it, and that just doesn't seem right to me. It seems like if the notification wasn't given like you normally would if you weren't in transition, then it should be covered. And why did you make the decision not to cover it? And those particular group of people during that transition period are getting stuck with this problem.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I'd like to, if we could take this conversation online, you know, there are many individual offline, excuse me, and maybe we can see what the particulars of the situation and follow up. With this member.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And that's one example, but I've heard of others because this applies to everyone. I just want to make sure that all the people, because I'm sure it wasn't just this one person in this period of transition, and I know other legislators have referred to other calls and concerns about this. So it's not just this one person. I think in general, we need to make sure that doesn't happen and that the notifications are occurring, because there may be another time down the road where we're also in another transitional period. How can we prevent this from happening? How can we make sure that those notifications go out? I think that needs to be part of the process, and the department needs to make sure that happens so we don't have people that fall into a situation like this.
Representative Hugh, through the chair. We did, specific to the physical therapy and the chiropractic, we did put an article in our newsletter in April of 2015 that went out to all members. And Aetna has met with the Chiropractic Association here in the state, and I believe have met with some physical therapists, maybe not all. I'm not sure if they were part of that same meeting or not, to discuss their clinical policy bulletins.
Follow up.
And I would think that communicating with the physicians, because people do look at their doctors, they like to, you know, they want to, the doctor knows best, I'm going to do what the doctor says. The doctor gave me a referral to go to the physical therapist, by golly, I'm going to go. So it seems like that's where the breakdown is occurring. You need to be educating the physicians, I guess, is my encouragement.
You're number three. Representative Kito, followed by Representative Tilton, followed by Representative Ledoux, followed by nope.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I actually have something similar to what Representative Hughes brought up, and there is something that we're working on, but a constituent has contacted us with a situation where they were on autofill for a prescription, very expensive immune prescription, and they were not informed, and the pharmacist was not informed, and at a certain point they received a non-payment from their pharmacist for $50,000. And nobody was notified, and they're in a situation where, what do? They can't afford to pay that. They're having to work through our office to try and address that issue, which is something that should have been identified immediately when the coverage had changed or the situation had changed. So those are things that are extremely important and very detrimental or very devastating, I think, for the families that have to experience that. I mean, can you imagine opening up the mail and seeing something that says you owe $50,000? That can be quite a shock.
Representative Kino, through the chair, I don't imagine anyone would be pleased to find a $50,000 bill, and we will try to work through these issues as we can. The transition, as we all know, was not very smooth. We're of the opinion things have gotten better over time, But, you know, we'll work through these issues as they arise.
Representative Ledoux, I guess.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions. So you talk about making the transition from Wells Fargo to Aetna. Is this what we're talking about here?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, from HealthSmart was our previous health administrator.
Okay. I guess I don't understand why changing an administrator changes the terms of the policy. I mean, if you've got a policy which is supposed to give X, Y, and Z, why would changing the administrator change the terms of the insurance policy?
And generally, it should not. I agree with you. So, but there are administrative things that happen when different people are executing our plan.
So to follow up or new question?
Yeah, well, it's kind of both. I mean, a $50,000 bill isn't just a little, you know, administrative thing. I mean, obviously, one administrator decided that this wasn't within the terms of the policy, and another administrator decided that it was in the terms of the policy. So did you folks get a legal opinion or anything to see what actually legally was in the terms of the policy?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, you know, there's millions of different procedures, millions of different procedural codes and combinations, and it's different based on your own personal medical history. So there's no way to actually identify every, you know, occurrence within a plan document. So instead, we reference things such as medical necessity. And the plan document has relied historically on the medical necessity as determined by the claims administrator. Previous claims administrators made medical necessity determinations, and now Aetna is making those medical necessity determinations for us. And as I referenced earlier, one of the things that Aetna has that our previous administrators didn't have is these public clinical bulletins for both pharmacy and medical, which show what they are using, the medical evidence that they're relying on to make these determinations. And so you know, medical science itself changes. So, you know, something that would have been covered a year ago, they may have had new clinical studies that shows that there's, you know, danger. You see the commercials all the time about the lawsuits and everything. So there's going to be changes in something that was covered previously that isn't covered now. And so we rely on the third-party administrator to keep up on medical evidence and make the medical necessity determinations based on that, but we don't necessarily memorialize that level of detail into the plan document, if that makes sense.
Well, I hear what you're saying.
Is that a question or a follow-up?
Just a follow-up comment. I guess when you say that you've sent notice through the newspaper that people get, I mean, most people don't really, you know, read the fine print in a newspaper. It would seem to me that if you're going to make significant changes that could end up with somebody being liable for a significant amount of money, that should go with actual notice, with you sending people notice. So, thank you.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to change the line of questioning just a little bit. And you talked about you have the providers that are that's not in contract. What is that called? They're
out of network.
Yeah, in and out of network. And my question is, who's determines and has the determination made of whether a provider's in or out of the network?
Representative Tilton, through the chair, with our third-party administrators, they bring their own network. When it was under HealthSmart, they actually contracted with another company, Beach Street, to bring us the multi-plan network that we had previously. Aetna has their own individual network, and so Aetna is the entity that goes out and contracts with the various providers. So they will contact the providers, but we can't force a provider to join the network. They have to be willing to abide by the terms of a network agreement and the rates and everything else that go into one of those agreements.
Thank you.
I might add that we're with a number of problems on the Kenai Peninsula, and so far their performance has been less than stellar. We get more complaints on that than we do on just about anything other than OCS issues.
We freeze here.
I'm not sure what I did.
I don't know what happened. We lost her. There we go. It went to sleep on us, I guess. So I want to say that this administration was very sensitive to what happened in the Aetna transition. And we wanted to kind of establish a baseline of what customer satisfaction with the healthcare plans that Alaska Care delivers. We thought that this was a very important thing for us to do, because as there are many stories that we have heard. And so we're trying to get a sense of what the universe is as well. Not to say that anything we've heard today is good or excusable, but it is a large plan, and so we're trying to judge the overall character and the overall satisfaction. And so in August, we commissioned a study with a professional organization by the name of DSS, and we surveyed a little over 700 people for us so that we'd have a statistically valid sample. We looked at the total retired and active population of the total surveyed. About 562 were retirees and 151 were active, so it kind of represents that 80-20 in terms of the overall membership. And then although it wasn't each wasn't statistically valid, we also asked our survey provider to draw the sample so that we could look at demographics such as retirees in Alaska versus those out, because a significant portion of Alaskan retirees are served through the Aetna network that is outside of the state. And so we wanted to see if there was, for instance, a differential in opinion as to how Aetna may be delivering in-state versus out-of-state. When we looked at this in terms of the overall satisfaction related to the medical plan, if you look at the bottom two bands, which means that the member responded with either not too satisfied or not at all satisfied, we were like at the 15% range for the total population, but that did vary between, for instance, retirees in Alaska and retirees outside of Alaska and the active plan. So this was an interesting finding for us, maybe not too surprising given some of the network challenges that we've had. And so.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. I'm not asking you to go back to slide 5, but you show that it costs 4 times as much for the state to cover the retirees as the active. After age 65, Aetna is secondary to Medicare. So I'm just wondering why. Don't they pay 90 cents of a 66-year-old retiree's benefit, and then the other 10 cents is picked up by the state? Isn't it something like that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct. However, you have to remember that the U65 retirees are probably the most expensive cohort in the entire population. And so you have a combination there. And I think overall the retiree plan recently is benefiting from the wave of baby boomers that are crossing Medicare eligibility. And so that is holding down a trend cost by the exact phenomenon that you're talking about. There is a percentage of our population, though, that is not Medicare eligible at all, depending upon your date of service. I, for instance, have been a state employee since 1982 continuously, and never been a part of Medicare. So, and as well too, there as far as the Medicare does not stretch internationally as well. We have a certain percentage of our population that lives outside of the country.
And mm-hmm. Sorry, another important note is that we are not secondary for prescriptions. So the over 65 population has a very large pharmacy.
Now, following up, I believe the figures, when you look at the overall spend, I don't know if it's the U65 or the entire retiree spend, pharmacy has just crossed over 50% of the total spend. Yeah, it is, and so that high pharmacy trend is concerning for that particular.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like the dissatisfaction among the in-state retirees is about double the out-of-state, and you mentioned it was because of network provider challenges. Could you just explain that? Is because they're ending up paying more because they're more expensive, or there aren't very many in it, and maybe it's mm-hmm. the least favorable provider in that community that they want right. to see, or what is the network provider challenge? Why is it twice, the dissatisfaction twice in state than out-of-state?
Well, Representative Hughes, through the chair, we did ask follow-up questions for those that indicated dissatisfaction, and they gave a number of reasons, but some of them were dissatisfaction in how the claims were processed, inadequate or a very confusing explanation of their benefits, particularly for retirees. The coordination with Medicare has been a challenge, and the EOBs are not very good when it comes to that particular piece. Or they feel like they don't like our administrative policies at all. And also poor customer service. Those were some of the reasons that were listed, and that was a text field on this particular survey. So we tried to pick some representative. So we don't have an idea of which is weighted more, but so those are some of the reasons that were given. I hope that's helpful.
Paul, I don't see how a state border makes a difference for some of those things that you mentioned. So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You said the size of the sample was 700 and
overall, correct?
I'm assuming it was proportioned on a population basis. So in my case, the Kenai Peninsula is about 10% of the state population. So that meant that 70-some people got contacted on the Kenai Peninsula, which has four house districts, which means that if I was lucky, 15 or 18 of my people would have been contacted, as would Representative Seaton's and Representative Chenault's.
That's a good question, Chair Olson. I do not know. Geography other than in-state or out, I do not know if it was geographically representative. It was random, so I assume it would be, but I do not know.
What I was going to lead into is when I do polling in my district, either on me or on issues, I usually use a sample that's 450 to 500, and I have a margin error of approximately 4%. Mm-hmm. So, when you're aggregated, you probably do have a pretty good reflection of the whole state, but it certainly isn't by geographic area. I would imagine the bush would probably have be down at the bottom a lot more because they have less services available. Same with Kodiak in the southeast, Anchorage and Fairbanks, and probably Juneau have enough of everything to where they probably are relatively happy. But when you get into the smaller people where we still have state employees and retirees, it's a different story.
Representative Olson, through the chair, I think you're you are accurate in terms of, you know, is this, I guess what you're saying is this number representative of every area within the state, and it was not intended to represent each individual area. We'd probably get varying results, as you indicated, if we had isolated in on individual geographic areas. But, of course, the expense of the survey, if we were to try to get to that detail, would have been significantly higher. So we had resource constraints. And this was the first time, as far as I know, that anybody's even cared to ask the questions. And so I guess what I would like to get a brownie point or two for is that at least we're asking and trying to tease that out. And we did get some feedback, for instance, from the Retired Public Employees Association related to this survey, and they had some suggestions as to how to improve it. And that's something we hope to do in the future. So I appreciate your input.
Well, to speak for everybody on this, I think if we felt that you weren't trying and doing a good job, there would be a whole series of new questions that would probably not be as friendly as the ones you've had so far.
So,
anybody have a question hanging out there that I missed? Yep. Please continue.
Next slide is essentially the same question, but let's talk about, this is how the pharmacy benefits were viewed. And interestingly, across the board, at least if you look at these, I would say that the results were very similar no matter where you were. Demographically, there didn't appear to be any difference. Between 8 and 9% of the total population was either not too satisfied or not at all satisfied by the benefit. And so, kind of following up, so what sort of feedback did we get from those people who were not satisfied? They were dissatisfied with the benefit coverage. They were dissatisfied with the difficulty in using the mail order. How claims were processed, a dislike of the administrative policies, and poor customer service. So. One of the things that this administration focused on, next slide, is we had heard anecdotally and through a number of members that the Aetna call center was not helping our members. And so we tried to do a deep dive, both in this survey, on that particular issue. And when we looked at this, it did show that there was a significant percentage of the population that was unhappy with that particular dimension of the service. Whereas, you know, almost 25 to even 30% across the board were unhappy with this particular service. Now, I will note that not everyone of those 700 people used this particular service. So we're looking at a subset, and the margin of error is probably higher. But it still was, there was a significant enough difference here, that plus what we had generally heard from people was a concern to us. And so I want to talk a little bit on the next slide about, okay, who is the call center? The call center is, they handle about 89,000 calls or so a year. They're a dedicated team that resides in Fresno, California. And when we look at this particular, some of what I would describe as the metrics for a call center, you know, they look pretty good. 94% first call resolution based on a follow-up survey, 98% that the call was accurate, it kept the core values, 1.2% abandonment rate, and 85% answered within 30 seconds. But we still really were not satisfied with the performance, and this was not what we valued. In terms, because the Aetna service is described as a concierge service, actually, as a result of the conversations with Aetna, they were levied a significant penalty, and our performance guarantees, over $500,000, was essentially lost to Aetna in this particular space. We also contracted with a third party, Siegel Corporation, one of our consultants, to do an on-site review of the call center, a neutral party on-site review, and also some of our staff went to essentially listen to the calls. The overall findings were really that Aetna is providing pretty good frontline customer service. Their CSRs are generally pretty well trained on our Alaska Care Plan, but the level of service is not quite what we think we signed up for. And in some cases, for instance, customers weren't getting what it was promised as concierge-type treatment.
And, could I make one recommendation that won't cost you a cent, if you haven't done so already? And that's require anybody that talks to the retirees, the active employees, the concierge, anybody at the TPA, require them to use their full name and or their employee number.
Okay.
So it can be written down, and they can say, well, I talked to somebody in your office last week, or I talked to them. They'll know who they talked to. And then if there is a pattern of maybe just a handful of people that are responsible for the misinformation or whatever getting delivered, you'll know who it is.
Yes. And Cheryl's, and I do believe that the customer service representatives are required to say at least their first name, but I am not certain about an employee number.
How many Johns do you think there are?
agreed. So
Representative Ledoux.
I just want to comment here that at least with this service, you've got a telephone number that you can get through to. I mean, in the past, and I'm not sure which one of the administrators it was, I mean, you'd be routed around so that it was actually almost impossible to talk to a person within the first 10 minutes.
And Representative Ledoux, we believe that this is the face of our plan. And we believe that our customers will be happy if they are treated well in this space. It is a core value for us. That is why we have tied so much of the performance guarantees to this. And I think that is a message that Aetna has received and has been responsive to. We are working with Aetna to clarify what our expectations are, and they are providing additional customer service training as necessary. We're in the process of developing a project plan to understand, for instance, one of the themes that we heard was, you know, our members having to repeat calls. Have to call again, and getting different answers and those types of stories. And so through our conversations with Aetna, they're developing a software tool to track these repeat callers. And I'd like to say that I think that the message is getting through. Michelle just got a story the other day of an individual who was having difficulty getting a prescription. She called in. It was a repeat call. She got routed immediately and automated to the same CSR that she had dealt with this problem before. He stayed on the phone with her, stayed in touch with her, and it was really the kind of service and the kind of success story that we would like to hear more often. It was just little things. For instance, a customer service with all good intentions of trying to help the member went to a copier and made 14, 15 copies. And, you know, so the member on the phone is wondering, you know, are they coming back? And so we've talked to them about these types of things. And we think that this more touch, more often, will be a really positive thing for our members, as well as helping their resolution. And I will say too that Aetna has told us that, you know, that there are other working groups in this Fresno call center, and there is a certain status to working for this plan. which we value, since we think it will serve our members well. So, but, you know, this is an area that we're going to continue to be vigilant on. We plan on doing quarterly call monitoring, doing random samples to see, you know, how we're doing in this space. So,
Representative Kito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boucher, the penalty amount actually brings up another question that I don't know that I fully understood regarding the Aetna fee. And so the Aetna fee that you've identified previously, $16.4 and $15.5 million, is that over and above the expense of their activity, or does that pay for their activity? And if it is an expense over and above, how is the activity of Aetna's administration of our plan paid for?
I guess I can best describe this as we have a base fee and fees at risk. And depending on different aspects of their performance, they would be rewarded or penalized based upon that. Does that help?
Yep.
So I guess my question really is the fee, the $15.5 million, their entire cost for administering the program, or is that the over and above the cost of administering the program?
Or the adjustment?
So does the $16.4 and $15.5 million pay Aetna for all the work they're doing, or is that what they get for doing the work?
So the base, right?
Yeah, the base for the adjustment.
So does that pay? Does the 15.5 pay for the employees of Aetna to do the administration?
I can answer that question. I don't know that I can answer that question, Senator Kito, but I will try to follow up and answer it.
How many pages is the contract roughly with Aetna?
Well, we currently don't have. We're still working to finalize a contract. We don't have a contract. We have a letter of agreement. The letter of agreement is about 16 pages, I believe. Mm-hmm. The full contract would be, you know, 300, 500.
Is it confidential at this point in time? Or
the letter of agreement is actually posted on our website. It is not confidential.
Perfect. Thank you.
So in addition, there were other performance issues that we had with Aetna in 2014. These are in addition to the over 500,000. So overall, it was nearly 1.2 million that Aetna was penalized for the performance in 2014. And because of that, you know, we had, as you may know, when the administration came in, the contract was not signed, as Michelle indicated, and so we've been in process to try to get to an agreement that, as this administration knew better what we wanted to make sure it represented the things that we valued. And so for 2015, for instance, as we said, Aetna restructured the contract so that we put an additional amount of money at risk, and there are different guarantees that are part of the structure. So now, of course, as I said earlier, the reason that Aetna really won this RFP was the value of the network that they brought. And as we both know, the more network providers we can offer our members, the better off we are. And we have had some success in growing the network, but I will say it has been challenging. And but there has been consistent growth in the network, about 600 additional providers over the 2 years.
Representative Josephson.
On that topic, I, since I was first elected, had ankle surgery, and at the time that I had it, was the fall of 2013, the only orthopedic person that was on the preferred provider list was Dr. Vermilion. So in the entire city of Anchorage, there was one orthopedic surgeon. And is that improved? Just so you know, sorry to interrupt you, but I chose someone else who had a more narrow specialty, and I was very satisfied with the amount that I paid versus the amount you paid, and it all worked out. But mm-hmm. I just was surprised that there was one orthopedic surgeon on the list.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there are pockets of providers, and orthopedists being one of them, that are very reluctant to join the network. Heart specialists, that we've, Aetna's continued to try to bring them in into the network, but it is very challenging. And so we're looking for strategies to try to address this within our plan.
Just follow up. Mm-hmm. Is it as simple? I don't mean to denigrate the wonderful surgeons out there, but is it as simple a mathematical calculation for them as saying, "I'd rather pay, you know, receive the extra 10% and not be listed as, you know, front and center for all these people as their first choice through the insurance company?"
Representative Joseph, through the chair, I won't speak for any orthopedist. I don't know what their motivation is. But, you know, the facts are, as far as I know, that compared to similar procedures that are conducted elsewhere, oftentimes specialists are, say, 300 to 400% higher in the state. And
that was in the list that went out to members last week. It was basically on workers' compensation, but it was the same mm-hmm. procedure codes that are being addressed. Mm-hmm. Representative
Thank you, Culver. Chairman Olson. Mr. Boucher, so are a lot more patients then electing to travel to, like, Seattle for care because of this lack of preferred providers?
I Representative Culver, through the chair, I can't speak to the volume that is happening, but in terms of our population, but.
Representative Hughes, followed by Representative Villadue.
Are there preferred providers outside the state? I guess I just dawned on me. I don't know that.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, yes. They would be part of the Aetna network, and they deliver, for instance, many of our retirees who live outside of the state use preferred providers.
Is that in Arizona by chance, or...
Is that where you want to go?
that's where most of them are, I think.
We do have a large population in Arizona.
Representative Hughes, followed by Ledoux, followed by Keto.
I'm done.
Oh. Representative Ledoux.
So if somebody can show you that they can get the procedure done cheaper outside of Alaska, will you pay for their insurance, for their travel, along with a travel companion and somebody to take care of them during their stay?
Michelle. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, there is in both the active and the retiree plan, there is a provision for surgery less expensive elsewhere. So if you can demonstrate that it is less expensive, even with the travel, to receive the procedure somewhere else, we will pay for the travel. However, we do not pay for a companion.
So sometimes it may actually be if the cost of procedures here are 400 times the cost of procedures perhaps in Arizona or California, wouldn't it be beneficial to actually pay for a companion to travel? And if it would be financially beneficial, why would you not do so?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's something that we're looking at. It is common now on certain procedures, for instance, full hip replacements and those types of things, to have what I would describe as a wraparound package that includes everything from picking up the person at the airport to making, you know, and their companion and taking care of the surgery, et cetera. Generally, those are facilities, though, that you may have a exclusive contract with. And so we're exploring those types of relationships, but there is a balance here because of Alaskan providers. That's, I think, you know, what we're trying to evaluate.
But I think I listened to the presentation from the workers' comp people, and I think in workers' comp they pay for the travel companion. So I guess I wouldn't see why the state of Alaska, under their plan, wouldn't pay for that. I mean, when it can be demonstrated that it's cheaper.
Mm-hmm. I understand, and we're looking at that. And in some instances, Representative Ledoux, for instance, transplants, there is a companion that is paid for. So it is some but not all, a subset.
Just one more follow-up?
One more. We're running out of time.
Okay. So at what point do you think you might make a decision about this? You say you're looking at it. Mm-hmm. So,
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, some of the conversations that's happened about it is, should we have, for instance, a process to go through to determine whether or not a companion makes sense? So whether it's – so that – you know, there are certain surgeries, for instance, that maybe you don't need a companion. So, but
Representative Kudo, followed by Representative Culver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a suggestion, I think you had mentioned that there was we had seen that there was a difference in the customer satisfaction from retired out of state versus in state. Mm-hmm. And it might be worth considering that one of the probably strongest reasons that I've seen as a difference is the fact that out of state there's probably a robust network, in state there's not, and in state, because of limited numbers of providers, you may not see a very large number of subscribers. So we might need to relook at the out of network in network discussion with Aetna as we look forward to the contract. So, mm-hmm.
Representative Culver.
There is supposed to be excellent medical care for like major procedures internationally. Do we have people going to any of these spots that have specialists like India, Thailand, they're covered by Alaska Care?
Representative Culver, through the chair, yes, our coverage is good worldwide. So if they choose to travel to wherever outside of the United States, then it would be covered.
And does that generally have to do with their copay? Are they able to get better product at more reasonable price and less out-of-pocket for them? Is that what's driving that?
And let me clarify, the procedures are covered, not the travel. Yes. But I would assume that is, I mean, we do have part of our population that actually live outside the country and have chosen to leave the United States. Right. But there are others who travel, I'm assuming, either for the expertise or for the fact that they can get it so much cheaper in another country.
Representative Ledoux.
So when you say that the procedures are covered, not the travel, if somebody can show you that they can get the operation in Thailand for 10% of what they can do it here, you wouldn't pay, and even cheaper than Seattle or California, you wouldn't pay for that, for the travel there?
Is there a travel benefit?
No, ma'am. The travel benefit is restricted to the United States.
Pull up.
Again, I'd ask, why?
It's a good question. It's something we can examine.
Four more pages. No questions till the end.
Well, it's just so interesting.
We're just not an inquisitive.
We can bring him back in a couple weeks. Come back.
please, let's be done. Excuse me. Again, I just want to emphasize, going back to why Aetna was selected. when we look at the numbers in general, in terms of the percentage off billed charges that we receive from Aetna, it in both years it has run about 35%, and that translates when you look at the total spend at a little over $110 million, both in 2014, and we're tracking that if we keep on the pace in 2015. And our previous, just to give you an idea of what our previous administrator did, they were able to deliver with their network approximately a 23% discount off bill charges. And so what, in terms of a value to our members and to the plan, it runs in the range of $35 to $40 million that we would otherwise have spent. And so I understand the problems and with Aetna. I do. And believe me, I hear them weekly, daily sometimes. This is a vendor that has delivered savings to us. And if we can continue to address the customer issues, grow the network, I do think that in the long run, given the fiscal situation that we are in, we just have to try to make this a better situation. So you might want, I can go through these slides pretty quickly. What are we doing in terms of ongoing management of this relationship? We meet weekly with the Aetna team to go over issues and talk about our performance improvement projects. We are, as I said, we're engaging Siegel. Going back to, remember that 90,000 number I showed you earlier, we're going to do a claims audit. We're going to try to make sure that we're getting good, accurate data there. We're continuing to monitor those appeals as we go from level 2 to level 3 to make sure that we're not going through or putting the member through an expensive appeals process unless we truly believe that it's outside the scope of the plan. Next slide, we're trying to actively engage with the employee and the retiree stakeholders to discuss and resolve some of these customer service concerns that we have. We are taking a look at travel benefits, and we're working on updating our retiree information booklet. The last time I think that was done is 2003, is that correct?
Substantially.
Yeah, substantial revision. In the Aetna space, we're expecting, for instance, that some of these are, we've been hounding them really about the explanation of benefits, and they're planning to do a redesign. We think it's going to be rolled out this month, so we hope that will be an improvement from what our members are currently receiving. We've implemented some system changes. One of the points of pain for our members was coordination of benefits at the point of sale. In other words, I have two plans and they were getting the out-of-pocket wrong. So we've done a major effort related to that. As you may or may not know, Aetna is in a relationship with CVS Caremark to actually be the pharmacy benefits manager. And that was kind of an opaque relationship for us, because we would talk to Aetna who talked to CVS Caremark. Well, that was not working for us, nor was it working for our members when they were calling about their pharmacy benefits. So right now, a couple of things have happened in that space, is that when one of our members calls the Aetna call center about a pharmacy call, and they are forwarded onto CVS Caremark, our customer service representative stays on the phone, and we expect them to help in that process. And additionally, we're getting direct participation from CVS Caremark in our weekly meetings now. We did not have that before. And Aetna has also agreed to become more actively engaged with our retiree and employee stakeholder groups going forward. So it's a work in progress. And I want to thank Michelle and her team for working on this every day. By the time it gets to me, of course, it's a fire. She puts out many before they reach my desk, and so do the six members of her team. It is not the easiest job in state government, as you might imagine, and I just want to thank her and her staff publicly for that. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to come talk to you today.
I'd like to thank both of you, and this has been very enlightening to us. And anybody have any last-minute questions? Mm. Thanks, Representative Kito.
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess it's the CVS Caremark relationship. I guess is there a clear non-directional component of that? So if we have a member that is interested in getting a pharmacy benefit, they're not directed to a better price at CVS?
CVS is the administrator of the claims processing. So one advantage of this relationship, Representative Kito, that to the chair, is that through this particular relationship, the state has realized a significant increase in the amount of pharmacy care. It's rebates, right?
Mm-hmm.
So are they directed to a CVS Caremark pharmacy, for example? Is that
that's my, as a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Boucher, that's my concern, I guess, is if Aetna has a direct relationship with CVS, are our members directed to CVS pharmacies, and does that mean that they receive a savings?
Representative Kito, through the chair, they, although there are CVS pharmacies that are part of the Aetna network, there is no incentive to go there.
Right.
The mail order program is actually an Aetna mail order. We also have the Costco that's down in California that we had previously under Envision, mm-hmm, as part of that mail order network, and we have a Diplomat service that is part of the mail order, not the CVS. So
that answers my question. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Representative Hughes?
Yeah, this is a question, and I don't want it to be answered. I prefer it in writing, and that is if there is anything happening right now as far as looking at care coordination to save costs, because I know that was a big thing a couple years ago, and also group purchasing for actual medical procedures and such like that. I understand there are those kind of groups that are doing that kind of thing around the country and even here in Alaska. So that doesn't need to be answered now. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would like to say that we're currently evaluating a relationship with the Healthcare Coalition of Alaska, which we would essentially become a larger portion of a larger consortium, which could potentially give us and our members even more market share and buying power. So we're examining that. That's currently under consideration.
Do you have any Canadian pharmacies that are a part of the network?
I don't know the answer to that question.
We do not have network providers outside the U.S.
Yeah. Thanks again. And with that, we'll adjourn at 1 minute after 5.